Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this litigation update on the Federal Trade Commission's case against Microsoft. We're very pleased to have several excellent panelists joining us today for this discussion. We'd like to welcome Alan Grunis, the Honorable Maureen Olhausen, Rahul Rao, and Bilal Sayed to this panel today. And we're very thankful to have Larry Spiewak moderating the discussion today, who is the president of the Phoenix Center for Advanced Legal and Economic Public Policy Studies. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Near the end of the program, we will turn to the audience for questions. So if you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. And finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. With that, Larry, thanks so much for joining us today, and I will hand things over to you.
Thank you, Edie. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to our webinar today. Today, we're going to be talking about the recent Ninth Circuit decision, FTC v. Microsoft Activision. It's an interesting case with some interesting precedential and also policy implications. I'd like to thank our excellent panels for being here. Full disclosure, I did not put it together. I want to thank our executive committee's chair, Svetlana Gantz, for putting it together. I'm sort of a late minute addition to moderate this. So I will approach this as I was not involved in this case, but many people on this webinar were, as I have questions, and hopefully they will mimic the audience's questions. So with that, let us get started. Probably the best thing to do is to start, for those semi-familiar with the case, unfamiliar with the case, is to actually discuss the case itself, what it was, and what the FTC was trying to achieve. Does anybody want to give a quick background of the case real quick? That would be quick, just what the FTC's theory is. Bilal, you got just a quick summary, if you could, of the case?
Sure. I'll do a very quick summary, and you can tell me if I need to expand or if others want to expand. So way back when, 2023, I guess, maybe 2022, the FTC alleged that Microsoft's acquisition of Activision would have the effect of foreclosing competition in a couple of different markets that revolved around both the gaming market and the console market. The general theory was that through the ownership of a few pieces of intellectual property, particularly but not only the Call of Duty game, that Microsoft post-acquisition could favor itself both in forms of the game and access to the game that would diminish competition from other what I would call distributors of games, distributors of games, whether through consoles, gaming consoles, or through use of the cloud or other sort of digital-based delivery methods, right? The FTC sought a preliminary injunction from the district court in California, and at the same time or prior to filing its request for a preliminary injunction, indicated an intention to pursue and did file a lawsuit in its administrative system, you know, to review, challenge the deal on the merits. District court found the FTC did not meet its burden for a preliminary injunction. Through various iterations, the administrative litigation was stayed pending review of the district court's opinion by the Ninth Circuit. And after what I think is roughly 18 to 20 months, earlier this month, the Ninth Circuit affirmed the district court's ruling, you know, finding it had made no, you know, reversible error, and rejecting, you know, the mistake, rejecting the FTC's allegations or claims of mistake in both the standard and factual review that the court either conducted or applied. So I think that's a decent summary, but if not, let me know. Can do more.
Let's expand on that for people who are not familiar with how FTC litigation works. And thank you for that. So the bottom line is that this case, we'll get to the merits of a vertical merger in a moment, but my reading of the case is that, you know, this was about, the key issue here was this ability for the FTC to get, as you just mentioned, a preliminary injunction under Section 13B of the Federal Trade Commission Act. Now, what I want to do is, for those people who are unfamiliar with the way the FTC reviews merger and sort of the dual role that it serves, I do want to, just because I think it's really important, first off, like, explain how that process works. There's both administrative hearing and then the ability to go to court and get one. So Maureen, could you just sort of, as you're the former acting chair, if you could just sort of explain that to everybody, sort of, we're all on the same page about understanding how this works, as opposed to, like, the Department of Justice goes to court or somebody goes to court. This is sort of a unique body, and just to sort of explain that to our viewers for a moment.
Sure. So initially, as the FTC was created, you know, it didn't have the ability to go directly into court to stop a merger to get an injunction. It has an in-house administrative law judge and administrative adjudication function. But in the 1970s, it got the power to go into federal court to get an injunction to stop a merger before it's consummated. So it, like the Department of Justice, can, for an unconsummated merger, go into federal court and seek a preliminary injunction. The FTC has traditionally kind of phrased that as, like, we need an injunction in aid of our administrative litigation, but that was more like a phrasing thing, because the FTC traditionally, if it didn't get that preliminary injunction, would not pursue the administrative path and the administrative litigation. So the FTC and DOJ were effectively kind of seeking the same remedy or same, you know, result when challenging merger, a preliminary injunction to stop the merger. If they didn't get it and they didn't get it on appeal, then that was kind of the end. One of the interesting questions, and we could talk more about that, is, do the FTC and DOJ have the same standard? Do they have to meet the same hurdles to stop a merger to get a preliminary injunction? Or does the FTC have a lower standard because it's in aid of this administrative litigation? So that's essentially the question, is, you know, you go into federal court, you say, you know, stop, the parties, you know, shouldn't be able to consummate the deal because it's anti-competitive, or it's, you know, it has serious questions that the FTC's administrative litigation needs to resolve.
All right, great. Thank you for that. And that's where I want to sort of start our discussion. Having read the decision, including just reading it again right before this, so I was fresh for the conversation, you know, it seems that the main thrust of the court's ruling was focusing on exactly this the standard that the FTC has to satisfy. And the court was very clear that it is not the same standard, as you pointed out, that a private litigant would. It's not an irreparable harm standard. It's a, as the court said, it's a lighter burden. And they said that they didn't meet that burden. But let's talk about the standard, because this, you know, goes to future enforcement over, you know, I want to throw this up to the panel, you know, one of the things that the court is, I guess the FTC had made the argument, it's almost like a summary judgment motion, as the court said, you know, it's not like a summary judgment motion. We're not ruling on the facts. It's like, you know, you just have a burden. It's a lighter burden, but you didn't meet that burden. So what I want to throw this open to the panel is, you know, what do we think about that burden? Is that standard, you know, too high, too low? And it sort of expand on what Maureen just said about, you know, different from the standard the DOJ must satisfy. So, Alan, let's throw it up to you first and see what you got. Then we'll go to Raul there and then circle back to Maureen. So, Alan, why don't you start with it real quick?
Sure. So the standard usually is called serious questions that the FTC faces. And historically, there have been different interpretations, I'd say, depending on if you had Democratic or Republican FTC. So the Republican FTC would typically say, it, at least my understanding of this is, you know, it's really not a substantively different standard. We've got to prove the same thing. We've got to go into court same way DOJ does. The Antitrust Modernization Commission commented on the fact that there appeared to be two different standards and raised question whether they were in fact different or not, and, you know, were they outcome determinative in any cases. I think if you go back and look at some cases, you'll see that it could be a lower standard. And you know, my take on just observing this as not an FTC lawyer is that in some administrations, the FTC leaned in on having an easier burden because of the existence of administrative litigation, where they would say, judge, you don't have to decide anything. Just decide if this is a serious enough question. And we've raised serious enough questions to allow our administrative process to go forward. I think what's unusual to me a little bit in this case is that seems to have been a very big argument that the FTC made. They relied heavily on the difference in standards. And so that's my comments. And if I'm wrong, you know, one of the FTC people should correct me like right now.
Alan, I think you summarized it quite accurately, and others can weigh in. And I think there was this conscious effort in the Biden administration to say, no, we do. It is a lower standard for the FTC. It's, because we have this administrative process. One of the things that always bothered me about that, and one of the reasons why when I was at the commission, I didn't push that and didn't want to rely on that, is when you have two agencies both applying the same statute and whether your merger is being reviewed by the FTC or the DOJ is, for a very large percentage of cases, merely based on subject matter expertise or administrative convenience. The FTC can't review common carrier mergers, for example, but everything else is really can be like a jump ball, or, you know, it's just expertise. Is it really good government, even if you can, you know, find this wording in a case somewhere, to say, well, you know, you go to the FTC, same facts, same economics, same everything, and your deal gets blocked. But if it was at the DOJ, all the same things, it doesn't get a preliminary injunction just because of this difference in how the standard is articulated. I think that creates, you know, a great sort of question, should we have something that's outcome, can be outcome determinative, because generally if a deal gets enjoined, the parties abandon it. That is, you know, essentially supposed to be doing the same thing under the Clayton Act. It's this, you know, going to substantially lessen competition in a relevant market.
Let's get rolling here. So
go ahead. Yeah. No, I think, but agree with everything Alan and Maureen has said. I think what's really interesting about this question about the 13B standard and the DOJ standard, and to the extent that there's a difference or a delta there, I think there are different dimensions and different perspectives in terms of like what is the import of that difference, right? On one hand, Maureen raises like really great points about kind of like the broader policy implications, right? Like, is it fair? Is it fair that based upon, you know, a coin toss, does your deal get gets the benefit of a higher DOJ standard that they have to meet or a lower FTC standard? That's a policy question. And at least from my perspective, you know, at the bureau level, you know, as deputy director in the Bureau of Competition. And just to be clear, I thought I would be done giving enforcer disclaimers. Apparently not. I'm going to give an ex-enforcer disclaimer here. I just want to say from the outset that I was not materially involved in this Microsoft case while at the FTC, and that, you know, everything I'm saying today is based upon public information and from the opinion, and nothing is non-public. So I just want to get that out of the way. But you know, there is this question of like, you know, this fairness in the policy question, and then from the bureau perspective, I didn't always think about like, is that my role? Is that my role to make these ultimate policy decisions? Like, the policymakers made that call, right or wrong, and imposed a standard on the FTC, or gave the FTC a lower standard, and that call was already made. I still think that's a conversation to have. I still think it's a conversation that should be had in the community as a whole, but at least from an enforcer perspective, I felt that the decision was already made in terms of, you know, do you get a lower standard and should you benefit from that? And I think that Maureen's right that during the previous administration, staff did lean into that. I mean, that was a big component of this case. That's one dimension. That's one really important conversation I think we should have. From a practicing lawyer perspective, I also am thinking about what are the practical implications of this? You know, what is the implications of how the Ninth Circuit decided the question of the 13B standard? Because there are two things that are true about how the Ninth Circuit approached this question. One is that it reaffirmed, and I think relatively clear terms, it cited the language, it cited Warner, it reaffirmed that 13B is a lower standard. So that is, you know, not settled as the Ninth Circuit, but it's something that was affirmed. But the flip side of that is the Ninth Circuit executed on that lower standard and applied that lower standard in a way that is, I think, materially higher than what the FTC wanted and how the FTC viewed the 13B standard. And I think that's an important component to really kind of disentangle and kind of explore in terms of, now what does that mean for the FTC? Yeah, yes, it's arguably on paper a lower standard than DOJ's, but it is in practice a higher standard than what the FTC has argued and what may have informed FTC decisions to bring matters into the administrative court and seek a PI. You couple that with current leadership's skepticism in terms of some of the constitutionality of the administrative process with respect to double removal for the ALJs. And it actually raises an important question. Like, does this change the risk calculus for the FTC in terms of their, at least in the short term, at least for this administration, whether they're going to want to pursue challenges in an administrative process and seek a PI, or will they follow DOJ's playbook, which they're allowed to do, and go straight into federal court and seek a permanent injunction?
I mean, that's a great point. And let me just, going back to what I mentioned a moment ago, I mean, here's a quote from the decision. And I think you hit it right on the head. It's like, yeah, it's a lower decision, but to your point, was the FCC pushing to make it even lower? I mean, the court was you're right. They're willing to give the commission clearly the benefit of the doubt. You know, you guys have a lower standard. Hey, we're cool. But I think an honest question to ask is, did the FTC sort of, you know, push their luck, so to speak, in really sort of, you know, getting as low as, not that you blame them, but I think they did. Because, I mean, one of the things that's on the slip opinion on page 23, the FTC basically argued that, quoting the court here in italics that they provide, the FTC argued that every dispute should be resolved in its favor when it requests a preliminary injunction. And the court basically responded, quote, the FTC's proposed construe everything my way standard is more suited for defending against summary judgment dismissal of claims than it is for obtaining provisional affirmative injunctive relief. I mean, could one argue that the FTC really was going for broke here? It's a question in terms of the debate. It's a lower standard, but the court seemed to be saying to the FTC, is like, you're essentially asking for no standard. And I think that's sort of a hallmark of the previous administration. I know I've written several law reviews about it where it's like, I'm just getting away with murder because I'm me. And that was kind of the hubris that they had.
Let me chime in just for a second, and then I want to hear, I'd love to hear from others. I mean, I think, again, I think there's two ways to kind of interpret what happened at the Ninth Circuit. I mean, I think there is one way of looking at it, saying, hey, did the FTC push too hard? Did they go for broke, as you said? And I don't know if that's entirely fair or accurate. I think the FTC saw what the standard was and applied it. That is, like I said, that was a policy decision made by others that the Bureau, subscribes to. But I think there's another question. I think this taps into like what Maureen is getting at, is that there's a fairness question here. And to a certain extent, you know, the Ninth Circuit, the other circuits, they're essentially kind of locked into having to accept that 13B is a lower standard. We have a lot of precedent on that. They can't turn away from that. And so the question is, like, if a court is grappling with this fairness question, but they're locked into this framework that requires a different standard, what can they do to recalibrate? And I think that could be part of the issue here, is that the court is on paper and in words reaffirming Warner. It's reaffirming everything that it said, but is calibrating it a little to bring that standard to minimize the delta between that and DOJ standards, so that fairness gap, or at least a perceived fairness gap, is bridged a little. And I think this, yes, one you could look at is like, did the FTC go too far? But I think the other way of looking at it is like, is the court trying to course correct, or to correct what it sees as a fundamental like fairness issue?
Yeah, and just to add a little bit to that, I'm sure that in the FTC's briefing, some of the language about your job isn't to decide facts at this stage, and if there's contradictory statements, that can be evidence that there are serious questions that ought to be resolved in an administrative proceeding. I'm sure the FTC had authority, and this was not just a, you know, fly by the seat of the pants argument. What struck me, though, was how much weight they gave to having us a lower standard, and how they almost assumed that if we put on a decent case, an economically supported case, supported by witnesses, we have almost by definition raised serious questions, right? And the Ninth Circuit, I think in no uncertain terms said, no, that's not how it works. So Raul may ultimately be right that this is a way of recalibrating it a bit to say, you know, when we say serious questions, you know, it just doesn't mean you've got to put on evidence and then say, okay, we've now raised a serious question, that it is in fact more like what DOJ has to do to get a preliminary injunction.
Isn't it? So my view is this is quite a bit of a red herring for a couple of reasons, some of which are consistent with what Raul mentioned. But first, I'm really hard pressed to think of more than a very small handful of cases where this difference in the standard mattered. I've always considered CCC Mitchell as a case where maybe the FTC got the benefit of this lower standard based on some, you know, the court sort of throwing up its hands after walking through, you know, the law and the facts. But I really am hard pressed to find a case, a decision where it made a difference. I think the fact that the FTC can go into its administrative court does affect the behavior of some merging parties, right? If the FTC continues to hold that over their head, even if they've lost at the PI stage, at the district court and the appellate court. But I rarely see the appellate court or district court taking account of that. I'd also say that it is a little difficult sometimes to compare the outcome of FTC cases and DOJ cases, because the DOJ usually combines the PI stage with the permanent injunction stage. And I think the FTC sort of referred to this in its appellate brief, claiming that the district court sort of relied on the standards in permanent injunction cases in describing the law. But that brings me to another point, which is, notwithstanding this idea of serious, substantial, difficult, doubtful, you know, questions going to the merits, the district court, even at the PI stage, does an inquiry about the likelihood of success on the merits. And that, I think, by definition, requires the courts to go through, you know, what's now the Baker Hughes framework, going through the prima facie case, the rebuttal case, and then, you know, sort of the rest of it. And that seems to me basically equates the outcome, right? If you have to think about likelihood of success and you go beyond the prima facie stage of the Baker Hughes framework, you know, the defendant, the merging parties get the chance to lay out their arguments and evidence and support why the FTC's case doesn't meet, you know, the prima facie case is insufficient. So to me, in practice, this difference in standard really just not only you can't show a meaningful difference. I think the way the law has developed with sort of the burden shifting approach of Baker Hughes makes it irrelevant, because if the courts accept the Baker Hughes framework, right, in a PI case, the defendant gets to produce its rebuttal, and the court never says, we're just going to ignore that. And to me, that gets you to the same place as the same, you know, language in a PI versus permanent injunction. But and I think that touches on Rahul's point that it's, but I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think as a practical matter, it just doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, I saw Maureen, I saw you went off mute.
Oh yeah, no, I was just gonna say, Bilal, I think that's true, but if the court had found for the FTC here, I think that would have been the thing that said, well, now really, it really does, right? It really does sort of create a very different kind of approach, a very different unequal standard. The other thing, Rahul, I wanted to mention, I think you're right that the court, you know, was like, in some ways, it was more implicit than explicit, but when it circled back to being like, well, look, an injunction, right, a preliminary injunction is an extraordinary and drastic remedy, right? So I think there is like a discomfort in courts with saying, oh, we're just going to kind of rubber stamp. Like, oh, you say, you know, I said the government says X and the defendant says Y, throw it to the administrative law judge, right? I think there's like courts tend to be very pragmatic. And I also think, you know, often careful about sort of saying, like, you know, I'm going to be, the judge is going to be on the hook for like imposing a very extraordinary remedy. So I think however it manifests itself there, I think there is this discomfort with courts just sort of saying, you know, the FTC just raises an issue and it wins a PI.
Yeah, and I think that also like ties into courts' familiarity and in comfort with certain processes, right? Like of all the district courts, only a handful have ever had to grapple with the 13B PI standard. They have all probably issued a PI at some point in their tenure, and it was under the more normal standard, federal court standard. And so that is what district courts are. And even for new judges who come from a civil litigation background, unless it's an antitrust background, that's what they're familiar with. That's what their comfort level is. And so it makes sense for them to like graft onto that other framework. I want to just also like just really quickly agree with what Bilal said about the practical aspects of this, right? Like I think the Microsoft Activision case was actually a little unique in both the time frame in which the PI happened relative to when the complaint was filed and how long the case, or in this case, how short the trial was. It was a 5-day trial. Kroger Albertsons, on the other hand, was like a 3-week trial, right? You know, these involve multiple experts, like extremely 100-page long expert reports. I mean, these are, as much as the FTC has tried to argue in the past across administrations that 13B is a lower standard, defendants have also very credibly argued that, hey, the outcome of the PI will determine whether the merger goes through. If you don't enjoin it, the FTC will most likely drop the case. If you do enjoin it, we will abandon. And so that puts a lot of pressure on courts to really dig into it, regardless of what the FTC may argue is the 13B standard. And the FTC doesn't want to lose the case by over-indexing on a lighter standard. They're not going to file a complaint and have a trial on the papers, even though I think a very aggressive reading of a lower 13B standard would be that. So in practice, there's a lot of rhetoric around this lower 13B standard, but in reality, I mean, these are very, very comprehensive mini trials that happen on FTC mergers.
Okay, can I just put in one little word? Because I think I agree with Maureen a little bit more than I do with the two of you, but that may be because I'm ex-DOJ. So it's always irritated me that the FTC, you know, has claimed it has a lower standard. And certainly I think everybody on this conversation knows stories about clients who are before litigation reminded of that fact, let's say, by folks. And certainly there is concern if you have a merger that could go to either DOJ or FTC that FTC has a few more tricks up its sleeve than DOJ does. And so, you know, I think I really do think there is that it is whether or not in practice there are very many cases that result differently. There could be more merger abandonments because of this. There could be more expense for parties. And so even though I'm slightly left of center and I'm also a DOJ alum, I really do think harmonizing the standards is a good idea.
I'll just add one small comment to pick up on what Rahul said. There were some instances, I think when Leibowitz was chair, when John Leibowitz was chair, where they did attempt, and I think, well, where they did attempt, where the agency attempted to claim that the PI hearing could be held only on the papers. And I can think of, I think, at least one hospital merger where, you know, the agency had filed its administrative complaint and argued for a, you know, hearing on the papers, where the parties did abandon. But it was it was, I think, criticized. Court, I think, was criticized too for entertaining it. And you have not really seen that, you know, in the last 10 years, I'd say, maybe slightly more. And you really didn't see it over the last 30, 40 years either, except for the one or two instances when the agency was very focused on reversing the hospital merger losses. And really looking for any way to get those into the administrative system. So, you know, we sometimes criticize Chair Khan and the commission and under her leadership of being very aggressive. They did take this. They did do a 5-day hearing on this, right? And they did do, you know, 2-3 week hearing on Kroger Albertsons. I mean, you know, you don't get permanent injunction merger cases that go, well, you know, often beyond two weeks. So, you know, they were not as aggressive as they could have been if they accepted the idea of a very low standard.
So let me ask this before I move on to sort of the next topic. I mean, you know, how does this decision, or will this decision, do people think, affect the commission's thought process going forward? Does this case provide sufficient guidance, I guess is the polite way of describing it, that when the agency says, all right, I'm gonna go for a 13B injunction, you know, are they gonna go, oh, you know, this is a lot tougher, maybe I will, maybe I won't. I mean, how do you think this is going to play out, just as, you know, if you're the general counsel or you're the chair, and you're thinking, all right, this case is out, it's a Ninth Circuit case, when, you know, maybe an outlier, maybe not. How do you think that's going to play out? Just quick round robin on this.
I'll start. Look, I don't think it should have any effect, right? I mean, I think the strength of this case, and you know, when I teach antitrust, I tell my students, you know, you're going to learn three vertical cases that almost everyone you go end up and work with or work for has not read, right? AT&T, Time Warner, Illumina Grail, Microsoft Activision. The benefit of those three cases, and especially this one, is the adoption, recognition that the Baker Hughes framework matters, and that, you know, is the right framework for the agency. It's the framework they've adopted into the merger guidelines. So it really shouldn't have any effect. What it should just keep them from advancing positions that are really inconsistent with the way the law, particularly merger law, has developed since Baker Hughes. And I think that's what was a weakness of the commission under Chair Khan, that whether it was the staff or the leadership, they were advancing positions that were running against the way the law was developing under the Baker Hughes burden shifting framework. And that was just a mistake that I think they really did not need to adopt to win cases, but it put them in positions before the court where they looked to be advancing arguments that were that did not recognize the importance of the district courts and then the appellate courts in developing the law in factual, you know, in actual matters. So I think the current commission will avoid that. But otherwise, I don't think this case should have any real effect on how they advance their litigation agenda.
I actually have a different view, but from kind of coming from a different angle. So just yesterday, the commission issued a statement about remedies it has to do with the Synopsys merger, but where they cited this case and this very decision, right? And they said a categorical refusal to consider settlement complicates subsequent litigation. And they said litigation over proposed remedy is widely known as litigating the fix, and it does not always play out well for the agencies. And the site is to this. So I think that, you know, even though the Ninth Circuit didn't get to the issue of should the remedy have been considered because they found the FTC just kind of failed to make its case that the merger was anti-competitive, so you didn't need to consider whether the remedy was sufficient. Certainly the current agency is looking at this as an example of, you know, you ignore a substantial remedy at your peril, because a court is going to, you know, have that at least in the broader context as they consider your case. And sometimes courts are more explicit about it. That maybe didn't matter here, but it has in other cases where the government has been forced to, either they lose or basically forced to stop litigation and accept the remedy because of the way the litigation was going.
And Maureen, if I'm correct, I think the district court did take into account the remedies. I think the Ninth Circuit didn't. So like it did, at least at one level of this court, like it did have an impact, if I'm remembering right.
I think you're right. I think you're right about that. But I think it's kind of the bigger point of if there's a good remedy out there, you can't be like, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. The court's going to say, well, what about that?
Well, I hope we can get to talk about the litigating the fix issue, because it's a really interesting issue. But just to throw in my two cents, I think there is a lesson in Microsoft in terms of arguing the lower standard. And the lesson is don't lean so heavily on having a lower standard when you go into court.
I'll be really quick because I think I touched upon this a little earlier. I mean, I think if you're I think when we're dealing with the current leadership that is also inherently skeptical of the constitutionality of some of the administrative process, that on one hand earlier that, you know, you court the risk of a constitutional attack on the administrative process because you have this beneficial lower burden. If you take away that benefit, then you're courting a risk for no reason, possibly. And so is this case outcome determinative? Is this a nail in the coffin? No, it doesn't go anywhere near that far. But is it iterative? Is it just adding to a drumbeat of, at least for this leadership, maybe trending away from administrative case trials? Possibly.
All right. So let's, in the remaining 10 minutes we have left, I want to sort of switch gears slightly. And because I work at a think tank and I'm an academic, I'm interested in sort of the policy implications of this case and just the whole, if you will, sort of backstory, and to talk about that for a moment. Because, again, being sort of an outside cat, meaning I don't represent anybody in front of the FTC, I just observe and watch and think about things. You know, I think this case raises some interesting issues, raises a lot of different policy issues in terms of a couple different angles, and I'm open to discuss all of them and if anybody else to it. But, you know, my real thing is like, okay, this was a vertical merger, if you will, in the tech sector. I think it is a safe statement to make that both the previous administration and the current administration has a particular interest in that sector, particularly vertical issues. And again, not being a practitioner, but sort of doing some just quick research, I mean, it seems to me that at least vertical mergers in this sector, and you can go back to maybe the Comcast NBCU case, I think is probably the, you know, big one. And then obviously, as Bilal said, the AT&T Time Warner merger, it didn't work out very well for the antitrust enforcement authorities. The mergers all went through, although the NBC case had, what was it, like 30 pages of conditions. But, you know, there is some vertical integration. I know that the previous administration blocked the Amazon iRobot deal, which certainly didn't work out well for iRobot, which looks like it's about to go bust. But this is a topic that we're going to see more. So a couple of things. Number one, as we mentioned earlier, the FTC, even if we assume that 13B has a lower burden, the FTC didn't meet its burden. So I asked this question to start the discussion. Was this a bad case or was this bad law? Because even if we assume it's a lower burden, the court's like, you didn't come anywhere close to meeting it. So, you know, are we going to see more of these cases? Because I was gonna, then moving into that, and then I'll leave this open to the discussion. You know, the merger guidelines are very hostile to vertical mergers, the new ones, new merger guidelines, and particularly in the tech sector. And a lot of tech mergers are small firms that their whole exit strategy is to be bought up by bigger firms. And these are very often vertical cases. So what do we see with that? I mean, are we going to see more vertical merger enforcement? Because again, if you couldn't meet this standard in this case, and there's talk about exclusivity, what does that mean for merger policy going forward? I have no idea. I'm just throwing it out, folks.
Well, I just want to chime in just really quickly. First, I think Amazon iRobot was an abandonment, so it wasn't a litigated block, at least from the FTC's perspective. They abandoned because of a significant regulatory scrutiny from FTC and Europe. But there's also there were other vertical cases that also fell into a similar bucket, right? The Visa Plaid, I would consider to be tech adjacent. NVIDIA ARM, those were also abandonments in vertical tech markets. I think to me, just reading the opinion, I thought the court was just very clear that it did not think the facts were there. It did not think the FTC made its case on the facts. And so at the end of the day, at least from my perspective, I think the case fell on that fact. It fell on the lack of facts. That said, this case does underscore, I think, how challenging vertical merger enforcement is. I mean, it's a very tough playing field for enforcers, but that's not new. I mean, I think one of the things that's a significant difference between vertical and horizontal cases is that there's no super clean structural presumption on HHIs or other comparable legal shortcuts that the agencies can lean on. And so the analysis has to be inherently very fact specific. And without shortcuts like that, ordinary course documents become really critical, and significantly a lack of a smoking gun can be really be hard to overcome. And I think that was, part of what this court kind of articulated was that the facts were there and there was nothing in the ordinary course documents or past practices that would suggest that, Microsoft would have this ability incentive, or at least wouldn't have this incentive. They have the ability.
Yeah, I agree 100% with what Raul has just said. And I'd add to it, the AT&T Time Warner case, Judge Leon resuscitated or relied on the old 1984 merger guidelines, which had never been in the vertical context, had never been updated, even though both agencies' practice was much more sophisticated, was much more different. It was much different from what it was under those guidelines, which then spearheaded a need and Macon Delrahim and others said, we need new guidelines here. So I'm not sure I agree with the premise that the new merger guidelines are somehow super tough next to whatever they used to be. I think what's happening is they're bringing things up to date in a way that has been done periodically with the horizontal guidelines.
One of the things that I find interesting in this case and think it is a good, it explains it in a good way, is right. So for the vertical merger, it's foreclosure, right? There's not horizontal competition that's being taken away, right? So where's the impact? Now you're going to have control of an input that your rivals, whatever downstream need, and you're going to foreclose them, and this idea Yes, like your incentive and ability to do it. Like, yes, you might have the physical ability to say, like, you know, or contractual ability to say, like, we're not going to sell this anymore. We're not going to provide this anymore. And the idea that, well, then you would have the incentive to do it. What I think this case stands for is a word that's not often put into this incentive and ability formulation is to do it profitably. Right? Is this a profitable strategy? Not like theoretically, could, you know, you look, could a company do this if it decided it wanted to, but it, is it profitable for to them to do it such that it is likely that they would do it such that it, the deal is likely to substantially lessen competition in a relevant market? Like always, I always like to pull it back to what's the stat, you know, what does the statute say? And so I think this case is very good on that point, because then what it, I think what it looked at is the fact that it would not have been in Microsoft's financial interest to do this, right? And in fact, what we've seen since this is actually, you know, not Microsoft didn't withhold Call of Duty from Sony. It actually now has, I think, given Sony a 10-year deal with Call of Duty, right? When my understanding is the typical deal was 3 years, right? So it actually is making a lot of money, opening it up more, right? So I think that was like a really key distinction here is, you know, the court really looked at, well, would it actually be profitable for them to foreclose the rival? So I think it's a good piece of case thought in that regard.
Great point. Raul, Balil, do you guys have any comments?
Well, I'll just say, I think if I were interested in developing the law, you know, as a FTC leadership, I would bring more vertical cases, because I think, you know, I mentioned there were three here, AT&T, Time Warner, Illumina, Grail, and Microsoft Activision. The posture of all three was different. And I think that there really are some questions about how to think through vertical cases. I mean, Maureen alluded to them. She mentioned sort of the profitability. I spent some time looking at the ACCC's new or draft merger guidelines. And, you know, outside of the U.S., usually the phrasing is ability, incentive, and effect. And I think too often, and that was the phrasing in the framework in the 2020 vertical merger guidelines. But I think too often the agencies may gloss over or recently have glossed over the effect analysis, right? And I think that's worth sort of solidifying in the law if you're a defendant, but also developing if you're the agency. So, you know, I'm not sure there's a lot of improvement. Look, on the margin, we're going to get more value out of bringing vertical cases and developing the law than in bringing horizontal merger cases. So I hope they bring more, actually, and move to, you know, settle with, you know, on the horizontal merger side. But I think it'd be good to see the law develop on the vertical.
So there was another vertical case brought, the mattresses case.
Fair play.
So, spoken like a law professor, Bilal. I'd like to see more cases so I can teach more things to my students. Can I add just one thing to what Maureen said? What I found significant wasn't really the economics discussion, but the factual discussion that in all of the documents that there was no indication that Microsoft had any plans or had done any financial modeling or had done anything like withholding Call of Duty in terms of entering the deal. And there's a lot of factual discussions. There was one that was taken by one of the studios and it was distinguished in the opinion. But what struck me, I mean, just to add to this discussion, is I would think you have to have a really good factual record if you're going to bring a vertical case.
That just I know we're running really tight on time. I mean, just a couple things. Like this is just for the audience's benefit. I mean, a lot of what we're talking about, I think, is a conversation specifically around the console market. Like one of the things that was also, I think, relatively important coming out of this was there were two other markets that the court assumed were appropriate markets, the subscription gaming and cloud gaming market. And in neither of those markets prior to the merger was Call of Duty available, right? And so the court held, you know, very succinctly that you can't foreclose something that was never that was never open to begin with. And so I think that's an important component, that's important aspect of this. Larry, I think you mentioned just briefly about like the new merger guidelines. I think I just want to just quickly say that I don't think the new merger guidelines change anything about this case. I mean, I think that the theories that staff, you know, put forth graft on exactly under the current merger guidelines, even though this case was before then. I mean, I think the merger guidelines more or less memorialize kind of staff's pre-existing approach. And so you see continuity and alignment between how they argued and framed this case with what was eventually finalized in the 2023 guidelines. So I don't think the guidelines change anything.
Well, I'm proud to say that I brought this train in exactly on time at 1 hour. So I think rather than go on, I think we'll wrap this up here. I'd like to thank all of our panelists, Alan, Maureen, Bilal, Raul. This was great. I hope everybody enjoyed themselves. It was an excellent discussion, at least from my perspective. And Edie, I'll let you do the final wrap up. So thank you, everybody, for tuning in and for all of our panelists for an excellent, excellent conversation. It's all yours, Edie. Thank you.
Sounds good. Thanks. Yeah. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd like to echo that. Thank you so much to Alan, Maureen, Rahul, and Bilal for speaking with us today. And thanks, Larry, for moderating. We really appreciate your time and expertise today. Thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and other upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.